Hello, everyone. I'm John Melke, and this is Parkside Today. Some of you may already be familiar with the University of Wisconsin Missing in Action Recovery and Identification Project, or MIARIP. It's an amazing initiative focused on advancing the recovery of MIA service members by involving an academic blend of knowledge and research. Today, we'll meet some of the team members and learn more about past, current, and future projects. We're joined by Mr. Charles Konsitsky, Associate Director of the UW Biotechnology Center, founder and team lead of the UW MIARIP project. Ms. Samantha Zinnen, UW Madison alumna and historical research lead for the project. And Mr. Tori Tiedemann. Tori is a UW Madison senior pursuing a certificate in archaeology. He's a team volunteer communications coordinator for the project. Tori is also the non-traditional student representative on the UW Board of Regents. Charles, Samantha, and Tori, thanks for taking time to talk today with us about this incredible UW MIARIP project.
Thank you, John.
On the website, there's a description that involves PFC Lawrence Gordon, 2014 project. My question is, was that the first project that the team worked on, and how did the initiative really come about?
That is correct. That was the first project that we worked on. It was a civilian researcher in the city of Middleton near here, and he came into the center asking if we were able to perform genetic analysis to confirm the possibility of his findings. And what we did is we looked into his case. It was a historical case that he had brought to us, very unique. It was a Canadian soldier or a Canadian civilian who was working in Montana at the time during the war, and he decided to join the U.S. military. Joined the military, was killed in action in France, and then was declared an unknown German soldier and was buried in a German cemetery. So, very unique case. It's a very long story, but unique in itself, and that's what really introduced us to the MIA issue.
And how did the person just approach it from the aspect of, was this possible from a biotechnology standpoint, do you think?
Yes, that was definitely the purpose of his visit. It was primarily the DNA analysis.
Okay. I'm just guessing here, but the work must certainly be rewarding, frustrating, challenging, maybe all three. Also, the strong emotional element that has to be part of the work that you do. How does the team balance all of that?
The team balances all that, and it is everything you say. It is frustrating, rewarding, incredible. By staying focused on the mission, it's not about any of us. It's about our soldiers that have served their country and their families, and us hopefully being able to bring resolution and bring them home.
For this most recent excavation, we spent one of the last weeks that we were there. We were there during the 4th of July, and so there's always, I mean, generally the team members that go on the excavation already have a very mature emotional disposition, and so even in situations where we could be handling remains, we can't conclusively say on the site whether or not they're human. We have to classify them as possible osseous remains, and then the federal lab determines whether or not they're human. But at least for these cases, the past three cases, or I should say the past two cases, but I mean, everybody, how we balance that is we keep the sacrifice of the service member in mind, and no matter how bad the weather gets or how heavy the soil and the rock and the buckets get, everybody keeps in mind that ultimately this service member made a greater sacrifice than any of the logistical frustrations that we might encounter out in the field.
And what kind of reaction do you get from you know, family members who are involved in this, or the in the case of the person coming in to look for the Canadian servicemen, what's the reaction like, you know, after, in some cases, you know, more than a half a century? What is that like?
Extremely overwhelming, positively. It's hard to explain it, because you can see the final closure that these families finally have from decades of loss, from one family line to the next to the next. Even the nephews and nieces were extremely thankful. And we're not, I mean, it's one of the hardest things to define. And that's the number one question that people ask us, and it is difficult to answer.
And besides you're working in overseas countries, what's that process? Do you have to go through a process in order to get permission to do some of the work that you're doing? And, you know, currently the project, if I understand it correctly, is working in Belgium. And what sort of, do you find obstacles in getting those partnerships, international partnerships, or not?
I'll let Chuck handle the permitting side of it, but then I can speak to some of the logistical considerations, and so can Sam.
So on the permit side, typically the foreign agencies that we work with are very welcoming. One thing that people should remember is the U.S. fought for their freedom. So that welcomeness and that support that we get from these foreign entities is above 120%. They are there and willing to help us get in the field as quickly and easiest as possible.
Generally, where the burial or the crash site is, generally speaking, the landowners, often that plot of land is remained in that family, and so there may be a family member that was alive at the time and old enough to remember the events surrounding whatever military action took place on that site. And so we've actually met family members during our most recent excavation. And they were very interested, and they spoke with us, and just very, as well as emotionally involved, because this was something that had happened in the family member's formative years, something that he remembered, one of his earliest memories with, and he had other family members alongside him at the time, and so that's just with regard to the landowners. When we for the foreign partnership, especially with the most recent case and then previous cases, you know, we do our hotel lodgings. We try to stay as close to the site as we possibly can. That way we can maximize, you know, the daylight hours that while we're there, we can get to the site, we can work all day, we can come back and then rest and refit and get ready for the next day. And so we stay at local lodgings. Other logistics side, such as excavation equipment and on-site sanitation and food, we're going to all of the local shops there. And so we do develop over the span of 3 weeks to a month, and then all of these arrangements are made months ahead of time. We do develop local partnerships there, and the people, they're very supportive of what we're doing in our mission.
And to give you one example, the 2016-27 Fazekas case we were working on, it was in the middle of a cornfield. So we were underneath the sun all day long, through the rain, etc. But the eyewitness who still lives next door to where the crash site was allowed us to come to their patio and eat lunch every day. Yeah. And every day they would bring out chocolate to us. And we thought, well, that was very nice, you know, that they're bringing out chocolate. And then it was, I think, about a week until the end, somebody asked, well, why are you giving us chocolate? And they stated that was the first thing the soldiers gave us when we were kids, when we were liberated. So you can see how that impacted them. They still kept that land plot that they believed the crash site was on to make sure that that individual was recovered, and they were giving chocolate every day because of that impact. And they're in their mid-80s.
Wow. Wow, incredible. And Samantha, you had a perspective there.
It's always been an incredibly rewarding experience when you look into these cases and you make the connections with the towns and the communities. And if you look across all the crash sites and that are near communities or towns that Americans were trying to liberate, the connection can be seen every year throughout the town and their culture. They'll have ceremonies to remember specific crashes of those Americans where they'll not only did they try and bury those service members quite frequently if possible during the war, but they'll go to those sites. They'll have parades. They honor those individuals as people. If they have been identified, they'll try and get in contact with this descendants. And there is a palpable connection some 70-plus years on that kind of blows you away when you see it in action in real life.
An amazing experience. We're talking with Charles Kancitsky, Samantha Zinnen, and Tori Tiedemann of the University of Wisconsin Missing in Action Recovery and Identification Project. And I know there are other members of your team, and can you tell us about those folks as well?
Absolutely. So just the three of us, this is a small snippet of the team members. We've got Dr. Ryan Wubin, who is the division chief of pre-hospital medicine and a med flight physician for UW Health. He's the team field physician. We have Dr. Greg Jamison from UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha. He is our principal investigator for the forensic anthropological and archaeological work. Mr. Tristan Krause, who is a UW-Madison alumni, and he is he's been with the team for the last two seasons. We have Dr. Brett Hoffman, who from UW-Oshkosh, Fox Cities, and he was essentially assisted Dr. Jamison this summer. Actually starting all the way back for the 2016 and 2017 case of First Lieutenant Fizikas, Dr. Leslie Eisenberg, and she's a forensic anthropologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society, and there's many others. Mrs. Erin Hoffman, she's our translator for the last two seasons. We've had other UW students, Ms. Emily Eisman, she's a master's student at UW-Milwaukee, Ms. Miranda Kennison, who's a archaeology and anthropology undergraduate student at UW-Milwaukee. Let's see.
And then we have students not from from the state of Wisconsin either. We have students from University of Hawaii, West Oahu, Colorado State, and then also Texas.
Wow, that's a very diverse team that you put together with, and I'm, you know, kind of guessing here, but I would think that just the scope of the project itself would be of interest for people to get involved. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes, it is the case. We have probably a dozen and a half students on campus here who work routinely with us. Some come in on hourly weekdays. And then we have students who work with us during the summertime. And it is very diverse. And they're all different backgrounds. We have historical backgrounds. We have economics background. We have pharmacology backgrounds. We have anthropology, history, pre-med, law.
Yeah. Business. Just a couple other folks that I want to make sure that we name. Mr. Chris Zaychek, he's an MBA, Army officer, and he's pursuing his MBA here at UW-Madison, and he's been our operations manager. Mr. Alan Lee, he's a graduate student here in the anthropology department at UW-Madison. And then historically as well, we had Professor Sarah Clayton and Professor Nam Kim here at UW-Madison as well that have lent themselves to the field digging seasons and past historical or our past cases in 2017.
And what? Talk a little bit about the current project in Belgium. What's involved there?
So, in theory, we can't speak about cases, but we can kind of give you an idea of what we're working on. When we're working on a case, we don't disclose the case nor the site because of protection for the families. We don't want to give them a false hope, per se.
Sure.
But regarding a case regarding this summer, it was a very large case. It was spread throughout a field that was about 200 meters wide by 180 meters in length. And the 3 weeks that we worked 6 days a week, and we moved 304 cubic meters of soil and sifted through all that soil within those 3 weeks.
Wow. And from the getting to the scientific side of the project, taking the personal, the emotional side out, but the advances that have happened with the forensics research, is that what is allowing you to do this project today? That maybe you couldn't, let's say that it couldn't have been done a couple decades ago?
So we haven't stepped into that field yet because the last few years that we've worked, we are underneath the DOD contract, so we can't typically work on advancements. However, it allows us to devise new innovations.
Okay.
And with funding that we're hoping to see in the near future, that will allow us to actually apply these new innovations in the field and test new ideas. And that could be related to new shaking structures. That could be mechanized units that shake as well. It could also investigate new biological analytical approaches, i.e. performing the sequencing directly in the field in real time and having a positive or negative response immediately rather waiting weeks, months, or even years.
Mm-hmm. When you're working on a site, and you talked about the kind of gave the dimensions of the one area, 200 meters by almost about 200 meters square, are some sites, is it more focused in where it's a smaller area where you know kind of an area that you're looking, or is it usually a little bit of a broader scope to the site itself?
So each site, just like each case is different. It depends on the circumstances of the crash, what kinds of plane crash there, or if it's a land loss and it's a soldier in the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
That materially changes how you approach the investigation, as you can imagine when it's not a plane crash. But even the plane crashes themselves, depending on the circumstances, if it was shot down, if it was brought down because it ran out of gas, it changes the sites themselves. And it depends on what kind of soil or land that the aircraft or person impacted into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to give you an example, the site last year, as I stated, was very, very large. Prior years, it was a smaller site because the crash site was in a corner, or it was in a field that was clay, so it was impacted and it stayed impacted, kind of encapsulated because of that clay. It was as if, giving an example, a hammer hitting into the clay and the hammer just sticking in the clay, and that's exactly how the crash site was. It was well encapsulated.
Wow. And is it kind of when you talk about the, you know, sifting through things and somebody trying to picture the work that you're doing, are you're looking for things that may be quite small, but it's just a clue to where the remains of someone might be? Is that the case?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
It, just from when you're actually looking through. Looking at a site, you know, what you're trying to discover that helps lead you to the identification of someone, is it really small things, or you talk about something being a little bit more encapsulated? Are you finding different sizes of, or what are you looking for?
Absolutely, all many different sizes of ACW, which stands for aircraft wreckage, at least for the aircraft losses, ground losses. That would be infantry or other support person on the ground that you might be looking for something different. They might still be vehicular pieces, but with respect to the cases that we've done recently, absolutely aircraft wreckage. That's what we're looking for. So this is metal, aluminum, tin. Components of, you know, these are American aircraft that we're looking for. And in addition to life support equipment or LSE. And so once we get through or when we're, you know, in the stratified, basically as we get down through the different layers of soil and we find paneling and we find pieces of the instrument board, glass, anything like that, ammunition. There's oftentimes a lot of ammunition, components of whatever weapons were on board the aircraft, machine guns. And then once we definitely recover a lot of that. And then less frequently than that, we will find pieces of life support equipment, which are the things that the pilots and the air crewmen were wearing at the time of the crash. And so these would be things like clothing or pieces of a watch or helmets, rings, gloves, ID tags and masks, and any sort of maybe breathing apparatuses that they might have had up there, goggles, harnesses and parachutes and things like that. And so occasionally you will find life support equipment, and then sometimes co-located with that, depending on the nature of the crash and what actually happened to the site after the crash, then you might find possible osseous remains.
And then with that, with those materials that Tori spoke about regarding like the M2, the machine guns, they have serial numbers on them as well as some of the data plates throughout the plane. Mm-hmm. Though that information is what confirms that is our plane. And then it's even better if we find dog tags. Then that mm-hmm. confirms that we are exactly in the right location.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you spoke about it at the when we started the conversation. This has been extremely interesting. The team, you know, having a mission and staying focused, and just what you've described there as far as finding these different artifacts, I would think you'd have to stay focused, or you could just get almost untracked, right? As you're discovering different things, does that happen?
I wouldn't necessarily say untracked or distracted, but we do at times, you know, you can especially if you find something such as life support equipment, when you start finding things that aren't aircraft wreckage that may have actually been worn on someone's person, you can definitely get a little bit fixated. But the team is usually we're very good about resetting and then readjusting and keeping a focus and that it's shown. I mean, the team when they're sifting through soil, we generally have sharp eyes, and our concentration, our focus is there, and we're able to find, you know, whether it's possible osseous remains or fragments of life support equipment, or we're able to find that as we sift through the different collections of of sediment that we're going through.
I'd have to say one of the difficult issues that I have sometimes is when we do find something like the machine guns with the Social Security numbers on it, it's sometimes difficult to tell the kids, no, we need to step away, we need to go home, and we need to sleep, because some of these students would prefer to work there through the night. And, you know, no, there's a time, as Tori said, we need to reset, we need to rest, we need to be prepared for the next day.
Mm-hmm. And I would say in any other context, when you're looking at those historical objects, those of us interested in military history, of course, would be very, very interested, but that's not our purpose there. When the investigation's done, whether it's to the DOD or to us, the plane parts aren't of interest. It's about the person mm-hmm. and the life, and that's mm-hmm. what you focus on. But if it's in any other context, I think a lot of us would be more focusing on what's coming out of it that's not pointing us to the service member we're trying to recover.
Wow, incredible work.
And as I mentioned earlier, everyone is going into the excavation, whether we're starting on the surface or starting in a crater. Everyone goes into it with a very all the team members a very serious and professional attitude toward it. But when you do uncover possible osseous remains, then it just solidifies and reminds you, while this, you know, whatever situation we're on, we might be in a forest or a field, but where we're standing right now and this earth that we're moving, this is, up until this point, until we make a recovery, when and if that is confirmed, this is somebody's gravesite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, is the team focusing specifically on World War II, or is there a particular era or not?
So we focus on, right now we're trying to focus on Wisconsinites, particularly as the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But we focus on any Wisconsinite that's gone missing in any conflict anywhere in the world. We'll research them. And those cases start with a name, their serial number, their unit, and the date they went missing. And we flush out the case from there, going through thousands and thousands of pages of documents from various sources to try and rebuild what happened. And there are different approaches, whether it's a land loss or an air crash.
Mm-hmm.
But the result is figuring out the life of the person and what happened to them. So when you can get to the point where you can scout and go into the field, that person has long since been attached to you, and they become much more than a name.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be prudent to note that while we would focus on any missing in action service member. I mean, no missing in action service member is more important than another one. The last three cases that we've done, the tasking from the federal DPAA side, they've been the ones that have tasked us with World War II cases in the European theater.
Okay. And are the projects that you're working on, and I know we're getting close to our time here, but are the projects that you're working on, is it like someone has brought this to your attention, or is the team looking at the number? I saw, I think, in one of the news stories was approximately 1,500 Wisconsin service people missing in action. How is that determined?
So we look at the full list of the 1,500 missing Wisconsinites. As a historical research lead, I start that process for us, and I work with our students, who are great and incredible people that come and take hundreds of hours out of each semester to investigate these service members. But when we do have family members from Wisconsin that do reach out and ask about their family members, we do look at those cases.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what cases can we move forward and hopefully to narrow down that list. And so there's zero, maybe in the future, Wisconsinites missing. That's always the goal. We want to work ourselves out of a job.
Sure. And how are you getting, how are students finding out about the project, or how are they, coming to you to be involved in the project?
So at least on my end, I mean, it's kind of a snowball referral process part of the time. I mean, someone talks about it, or they've read an article about it, or like, for example, we're recording right now, they've heard it about it on the radio or the TV.
Mm-hmm.
My involvement with the student veterans organization here on campus, I've mentioned it to them. We've added them to our email address their email addresses to our email lists. With the previously named list of instructors from the anthropology and archaeology department here at UW-Madison, they speak about it to their students. In fact, that's how I got involved. My first instructor, Dr. Clayton, I told her what specific disciplines within archaeology I was interested in, and she referred me to Mr. Kanzitsky here, and then I became involved from there. I sat down with him for an interview and been part of the team since. And so Sam can speak to the history side, but my involvement was through the anthropology department, and then from there I've mentioned it to other students, traditional and non-traditional students alike, and student veterans.
I got involved with the program when there was a History 600 upper-level class on recovering MIEs as a pilot program for the DOD to see if students could do this work. That's how I found about it. But since then, we've had lots of history students, particularly from the History Honor Society on UW-Madison's campus, Phi Alpha Theta, that become involved in this project. And then when they are in class talking with their friends, they'll say, oh, I do this. And then some more people will trickle in and start working, which is great because with 1,500 missing service members, it's a lot of names and a lot of investigating to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's an incredible project. Thank you to you and your team for doing that work, and thank you for taking time today. We've been talking with Charles Kancitsky, Samantha Zinnen, and Tori Tiedemann of the University of Wisconsin Missing in Action Recovery and Identification Project. And I can't let you go without saying a special thank you to the staff at WSUM 91.7 Madison Student Radio on the UW-Madison campus. Without their help today, this program would not have been possible. Charles, Samantha, and Tori, thank you, and good luck with the project moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Laura.
To hear past editions of Parkside Today, visit uwp.edu/parksidetoday. Thanks for listening.